as I get closer to where he went off the road, I see a big black shape in the middle of the road walking. So I have to slam on my brakes and try to swerve myself because this thing is walking in the center of the road. Because I don't see a head and I don't see arms. I just see a really big, tall person, like big, thick legs and a big, thick torso. And they're moving very funny.
But to be honest, I wish I had have seen some of her vulnerability. I wish I'd have seen her in that space so that I would have language.
And he says, no. That's not why you're angry. That's why you're mad. Mad is on the surface. Mad is a surface emotion. You're angry. And anger is deep. That cuts to your soul. You are an angry young man. And I couldn't answer. I then had come to realize over the next course of a few hours, I'm musing to myself, and I realize I've been a victim my whole life. That's why I'm so angry. And over the course of the next 19 months, this man changed my life. He helped me to realize about processing emotion and how to forgive myself and forgive others. And that's where the metamorphosis really began for me. And I learned how to, I'm a survivor, right? I know how to survive.
I was understood for the first time in my entire life. And when I read those things and I learned, quote unquote, those things about myself that I had known forever, but never really had the semantics for, I couldn't unlearn them. Like I heard this quote years ago and it resonated with me so much. And it's like, you can choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you didn't know.
All right. Good morning. Today I have JT Maxwell all the way from Massachusetts. JT Maxwell. Good morning. JT is an author of a new book called The Red Brick Road. Welcome, JT.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great to have you on.
Thanks.
And you are here to tell us about the kind of, I think I want to venture and say this is a dystopian reality of The Wizard of Oz.
Sort of. I've heard it pitched a couple different ways, you know, like an alternative retelling and an interesting take on Baum's original vision of Oz that he could never have seen coming. To set it up, right, it's called Red Brick Road, and it deals with everything that has to do, not everything, but the Wizard of Oz, the books themselves. And my publisher and I, Chicken House Press, we had to do a dance because the film came out in 1939. And the film, we all know, is Americana. I mean, it is, you know, the first film that had color into it. It won Academy Awards. And the first time we see color, the first time we see Dorothy in Oz, in Munchkin Land, the Munchkins tell her to follow that yellow brick road. And you might remember she starts at a central point and kind of unwinds her way out like a nautilus shell. And if you look carefully, that yellow brick road is intertwined with a red brick road. And I remember back in high school, when I saw it, I had a history teacher, Mr. Kohlmeyer, and he was a big Wizard of Oz fan. And I remember asking him, where does that red brick road go? I hadn't read the books at the time, right? And he said, I don't know, somebody should write a story about it. And I put together a draft in my creative writing class, and I realized, holy crap, like this could be something. You know, like the creative writing teacher didn't say it was junk or anything. And then I tabled it. You know, I had forgotten about it, and I read The Wizard of Oz by Baum since then. And it turns out there's actually several colors of brick roads in the books. Or in the book, pardon me. And red is one of them. There's also a blue and a purple. So in the movie, though, when it came out in 39, there's this red brick road. And where does it go? And I thought it would be neat to have somebody from now-ish, because the book actually takes place in 2008. I suppose technically it's historical fiction, which is kind of ugly and sad and icky to say, but, you know, heck, that was 16 years ago. So it takes place in 08, and this main character, Brennan, is transported to Oz through a natural disaster, and he's pretty much told, hey, look, you can't take the yellow brick road. You know where that goes. You've seen it. You have to take the red brick road. And he does. In this, we see the characters, but not quite the same way as we saw them both in the book and in the film. And we had to do a lot of legal dancing because there are certain things that we couldn't say because they're in the movie and they're still under copyright, under trademark, and no, copyright, pardon me. There's this thing called public domain. I don't know if people know about it. It's been in the news a bit recently because Mickey Mouse is now the original Mickey Mouse. You know, Steamboat Mickey is now part of public domain. And that's where something's been around for 100 years, and after 100 years, anybody can use it in any way, shape, or form that they want. So where the book is over 100 years old, but the film isn't, we had to do some dancing as far as what we could use and what we could not use. The biggest, most noticeable one is that you'll never see a reference to Munchkin Land in the book. You'll see me get real creative with it. Munchkin Place, Munchkinville, you know, a whole bunch of iterations, but I can't actually put in there Munchkin. So I didn't. Thank you, lawyers. That's kind of the book and where it goes. And it's a journey of self-discovery because, you know, whether or not you realize it at the end of both the book and the film, Dorothy kind of has this realization, and my character, Brendan, does as well. So, yeah, I hope it's enjoyable. I hope people like it, and I hope to keep writing books. This is my first. I've got like 5 or 6 more cooking. I'm 11,000 words into my next one. I just have got to sit down and get it done.
Nice. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, sure.
So you had the idea for this book back in high school.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because I think a lot of people, and kudos to the creative writing class and the high school English teacher that gave you a little boost. That's great. And
yeah, I'll tell you right now, I can never thank those people enough. Between my history teacher, Mr. Kohlmeier, my English teacher, Mr. Gevermont, that guy was incredible. My creative writing teacher, Sister Jackie, she was wonderful. Like they were wonderful people to have in my life at that time to, I don't know, kind of get that in my head that, you know what, I can do this. I can write. I am creative. I can do that. I didn't touch it at, you know, once I left high school and I went to college, I was young, man. I was a 17-year-old freshman in college. And I was in Boston. And away we go. And to make a long story short one, I didn't actually start writing Red Brick Road until 07, when my youngest son was born, and it would be, you know, 2-3 in the morning, and I'd be up with him, you know, changing a diaper, whatever, and I couldn't get back to sleep. So I thought, you know what, this is a good time. So I started typing away, and I did that off and on from 07 until 2011. When life just got too hectic. I was still working in finance at the time. It was a Charlie Foxtrot of an industry. It kind of still is. I had another son at that point, so they were both young, you know, like 4 and 2. I was trying to work full-time. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to ice this. I'll come back to it at some point in time. I don't know when that's going to be. And so there it sat, you know, as a Word doc in my computer for 9 years, you know, and then in March of 2020, we all got sent home. And that's when I thought, you know what, I'm going to pick this up and finish it. And it was grueling because we also, quite by accident, moved at the same time. In June of 20, we closed. We didn't mean to, but my younger son is like an old house aficionado. And there was this old house that came up for sale half a mile from where we lived. We had no intention of buying it. There was a pandemic, but we were like, let's throw it. Let's see what happens. And they took our offer, and now here we are in this, you know, big, beautiful house. So I finished writing that summer. I ended up with this Goliath of 86,000 words, and I knew it was too much. So I started editing the hell out of it. I took out entire characters. I took out entire chapters. And I got down to about 77,000 words, which is when I started shopping it around. And I started with agents. Oh boy. That was an education because, you know, here I am with what I know is a good story. I know it's well written. It needs some cleaning up, you know, but I mean, you never ever done editing, right? Like I'll even thumb through it now and be like, oh, I can move that around. But so I started looking for agents and I didn't hear back from one of them. And it dawned on me, it makes sense. You know, I'm not famous. I don't have any kind of, or I should say I'm not famous yet. I don't have any kind of English pedigree. You know, I didn't go to a big writing school. Who am I? Like, you know,
not everyone is Tolkien. I mean,
there you go. Precisely.
You know, it's hard to compare yourself to authors that, you know, came from the great institutions and decided to, write as a little side gig. I mean,
yeah,
we can't always do that. Some of us are working the day job, you know,
dealing
with family life. And, and it's impressive that you took that time during the pandemic when a lot of us, introverts rejoiced during that time. I loved it. I was like, you mean I don't have to talk to anyone? I love this. I live in the pandemic permanently. It's great.
That's awesome.
I think the extroverts are the ones that suffered during the pandemic.
Yeah, and that was definitely me. And I'm, you know, to change topics, I'm very open about how I didn't know what I didn't know. As cliche as that sounds, I the pandemic beat me up, and I'm open about it. I didn't realize just how dependent I was on other people. I didn't realize how much of a social creature I was, you know, because it I thought, you know, I had these moments of not being social, and I was like, well, this is just going to be an extended one of those and it'll be okay. And boy, was I wrong. I recognized just how much of a social being I am, and it did a number on me mentally. You know, once things cleared and the dust settled, I started going to therapy, and just started to work through really who I was, because it, at the time, right? Like I got out of finance and became a teacher. I realized that my favorite part of what I was doing in finance was the training and educating and motivating and taking complicated terms and putting them into, you know, language that people could understand. So I left finance. I took a huge pay cut and became a teacher. And I taught math for a few years, and now I teach business. And so here I am as a business teacher, and now I'm also an author, because I see now, you know, with the help of therapy, that I am I'm a natural storyteller. Gift sounds so, I don't know. I'm always reluctant to use the term gift because in my mind, a gift is something that you're handed, right? And this is something that I've been working at. And I know I'm good at it because I've been doing it for so long. Precisely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I've heard, and I'm sure you have too, that if you can do one thing and you end up doing it for 10,000 hours, you become an expert at it, right? And I'm not at a point where I'm an expert writer, but I know that I've been telling stories my whole life. You know, I'm 48 years old. I've got ideas for other books that I need the time to sit down and pound out. But to circle back to it, though, it was this therapy that got me to realize that I'm a good teacher because I'm a good storyteller. I can do that, right? And I'm not the best teacher, but I also know I'm not the worst. Where I teach business elective classes, I know students want to come see me because the beauty of teaching business at a high school is that it has direct real world implications. I mean, like one for one, like there's no math involved. It's that simple. It's, you know, you want to learn about marketing, you can go out, you know, we'll talk about marketing and how important that is. I mean, especially with trying to do this, right? Another class I taught is entrepreneurship. And over this past year, during the second semester, when this book was being published, I brought my students along with me so that they could see this journey that I was on with Red Brick Road and trying to get it out there and trying to get it published and trying to market it and, you know, on and on and on. You know, business is the number one declared major at colleges. It has been for over 30 years, but there are so many places that do not teach it. They don't talk to students about the value of money and how it works and what taxes are and why they're important. And don't get me wrong, I recognize that information is only good if the person receiving it wants it. And there are a lot of people that end up, I mean, we see this at high schools all the time. There are students who end up taking a class, not because they want to, but because they were put there. And, you know, I recognize that especially now post-COVID, man, like people's journeys are all different, especially as teenagers. There are some that are further along than others. There are some that are behind others, and it's all okay. But where we've got an opportunity to put people in seats to learn about the real world, you know, those people should want the information. You know what I mean? Like, it's classes that I wish I didn't have to grade, as weird as that sounds, because the grade should happen outside of school. Like, I had one student in my entrepreneurship class want to start his own landscaping company. And I showed him this article that was in Mass Live, you know, about a 17-year-old out in Western Massachusetts who had started his own landscaping company during the pandemic. And here we are 4 years later, and this kid's got two heavy-duty trucks. He's got one of those massive ride-on lawnmower type things. He's got, you know, industrial weed whackers. He's got trailers. He's got like four full-time people working for him. Monica, this kid is 17. I mean, you can awesome. Do this. It's phenomenal. You have to have that awareness. You have to have that wherewithal. You know what I mean? In order to want to do what you want to do. And sometimes that comes later for people. Sometimes it comes earlier. I've known I was always a good storyteller, but I didn't recognize that it could be something that, I don't know, like I would really, really enjoy. I've always pictured myself as being an author. I just never knew for what. And things are all starting to make sense now. You know... again, I tell my students, like my wife, for example, at age 9, she knew she was going to be a scientist. Guess what she is? She's a scientist, right? Like some people just know. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, when I was 9, I was going to go play first base for the Red Sox. Didn't pan out too well. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just, it's funny. So
it's interesting to see the journeys that people go on to get to where they want, and the things that interject in their lives to realign them to what their true path is.
Yes.
And so I'm always fascinated with the twists and turns. Have you ever seen that meme? And it's like, it's kind of an old thing where it says journey isn't like the straight graph. And then it's got this squiggly line, like all over the top of the perfect angle. So this is what success really looks like.
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't look like, you know, I could see that as being really important when you're teaching like a business class or something to kids, like showing something like that is like the journey is never always 100% clear and perfect and direct. Sometimes you have to have faith and trust and keep this mission or goal or whatever it is in mind and trust that the universe will get you there. And as you are making these twists and turns, you're actually gathering, they're not setbacks.
No.
Yeah, they might be challenging. However, there can also be points in your life that are giving you the information and the skills that you need to get to there that you didn't know about.
Yes.
When you first thought about what you wanted to do.
Absolutely. It's funny. I'm at a point now where I try to tell the students that it's okay to fail as long as you're willing to learn from it. If the failure meant nothing to you, then why did you even undertake it in the first place? It's okay. And they are, I don't know if it's a generational thing or what, but I'm seeing at the high school that, and it's not just my high school, there are legions of teenagers who are absolutely afraid to fail. Like they are so worried about the social implications and what their parents might think and it, just so much of it, without recognizing that if you fail but you learn something from it and move forward and apply it, well, heck, that's okay. I mean, I'll tell you right now, like, you know, I was talking earlier about getting this thing published, and not one agent got back to me. So there's this website that if you are an aspiring author, you should know about. It's called querytracker.net, all one word, QUERYTRACKER.net. It is glorious and horrible all at the same time. And because what it does is it will show you what's going on with your queries to agents and to publishers, right? So I tried to find like 50 agents. None of them got back to me. Querytracker.net has they have a ton of publishers in there. And you can sort them with filters. And I went in and I sorted mine and I came up with a list of about 300 publishers that might be interested in Red Brick Road. And I thought, all right. So I chunked them into groups of 30. And I took my first group of 30. And it was a bit of a pain because every single publishing house is looking for something different. One publisher wanted the first 3 chapters. Another publisher wanted like an elevator pitch, you know, like a good 2-minute synopsis of the book. Another one wanted 1,000, like your first 1,000 words, so on and so forth. And so you get all of those set up. And I sent out my first 30 queries to all of, you know, to this chunk of these 30 publishers. And within 48 hours, four of them got back to me. And I was just completely floored that, oh my God, four of them, like, they got back to me. And they all said the same thing, which I think is probably going to be an industry thing. They all said, stop sending this around. Give me 30 days to read, you know, the whole thing. Send me the entire manuscript. And I thought, all right, cool. So sent out the entire manuscript to all four places. And within 30 days, like three of them got back to me within 24 hours of each other. And all three said the same thing. They said, this is not going to be for us, but this will be for somebody. And that fourth one was Chicken House Press. And they were like, yep, you know what? If you have not signed on with anybody, let's do this. And I was just completely floored by that, because there's something about persistence, and there's something about that stick-to-itiveness. You know what I mean? There's no substitute for persistence. None. There's not an app you can download. There's not a tweet you can send, or, oh wait, do they still call tweets? Do we call
them? I don't know
how it works. But yeah, anyway, there's no substitute for persistence. None.
Perseverance.
That's exactly it, man. Like, you got to have that. And you've got to have that stick-to-itiveness. And part of that is learning from failure, because the other thing that there's no substitute for is experience. None. Again, there's no app. I mean, you can read and train all you want, but until you are in the event, you never really know what it's like. So between the experience and persistence, you know, I knew I had something good here. And I am also, again, this side of COVID, I've had COVID twice. The second iteration of COVID actually did a strange number on me. This past September, I got it for my second time. This will make sense in a minute, I promise. So I ended up with it in September, October of 23 for my second bout. And I ended up not losing taste, but actually my taste changed a little bit, and stuff that I used to not like, I now do like. For example, eggplant, I used to find detestable. And now, like, baba ganoush is delicious. I had no idea. Like, legit, man. I had no idea.
That's so funny. I've had COVID quite a few times myself. And
it's not fun.
And I'm vaccinated. And the thing that I don't like about it is it's not really, for me, it really wasn't that big of a deal. It's just like an annoying cold. However, the thing that is really bad about it is for weeks and weeks afterward, it kills your motivation. And I call it COVID brain. It's like you can't do the things that you want to do, and you just don't care. It's the strangest side effect I've ever had. So, and I know that some people have it worse than others, and so I don't want to minimize that. However, for me, it's just like, it's just it's a lifestyle killer.
And that is the other piece of it. And, you know, why therapy is helping. It's because exactly what you just said. My memory actually ended up being kind of short circuited. And I'm actually in the middle of trying to figure out all of that. I had a neuropsych exam a couple weeks ago. I don't know if anybody listening has ever had a neuropsych exam. It's tedious. It's like 4 hours of algebra 2. It's just tedious. Yeah, you know, you just, you've got a ton of questions that you've got to answer, and all these different things to test, you know, what's going on in your brain. Don't get me wrong. It's fascinating, but it's tedious. So I'm waiting on the results of that. And I had a sleep study done and blood work, and we're trying to figure this out. And right now, best guess is that this weird memory thing that I have going on is long COVID.
That's so fascinating. Oh, that's really interesting.
It's fascinating, but at the same time, it sucks. Like I'm, you know, I will have entire conversations with people, and then 3 days later, I'll ask them a question that the conversation solved. And they'd be like, don't you remember we talked about that? And I have absolutely no memory of that whatsoever. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I'm writing things. Yes, very. And this is why I'm writing things down, because I'm trying to give myself ways to combat this. So I'm writing stuff down. I'm taking notes as we're going here. So yeah, that, you know, as you could probably tell, that was another tangent on a tangent on a tangent, which is what I tend to do. Are there any questions? There will be a quiz.
I love it. Such a teacher. And we're moving on. Yeah. So I'm interested in about the history of the Wizard of Oz. Now we all remember the movie. Well, maybe not all of us, but the movie, and it was released in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it was written around 1900-ish. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
By L. Frank Baum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Legit classic.
There have been so many. I don't want to call them conspiracy theories, but for a while I remember a bunch of YouTube videos going like, "Oh, did you see this part of the Wizard of Oz?" There's this whole pop culture, I think might be a nice way of saying it, around the Wizard of Oz movie. And it's such a classic. I still enjoy watching it. Yeah. And how it, you know, it starts off in black and white. And then you mentioned the Technicolor. Was this one of the first movies to come out with color?
Yes. Yes. It was actually the first commercially released film that had color in it. And a lot of movie houses weren't prepared for it. And they ended up kind of freaking out a little bit, and they had to spend money in order to upgrade their equipment. But I mean, clearly it was worth it. You know, people wanted it. You know, that you buy, I don't know if you're a history geek like I am, but 1939, things were starting to get real weird, man, because we were in a position where the economy was growing. You know, we weren't at 50 states yet, so we were growing internally, but also externally. And, you know, this was post-World War One. Hitler was just named Time Magazine's Man of the Year just before that.
But yeah, 1936 Olympics.
Yep.
I mean, he was, well, 1939, World War II. I mean, it was, I'm somewhat of a World War II history buff, so I've been watching these documentaries on just atrocities of Hitler and...
Yeah.
I don't know. Netflix keeps giving me new documentaries. And
me too.
I'm not even going to say why I think this is happening in an election year. We were not even going to go there. I'm just going to say that.
No. Nope.
But anyway, regardless, I am a history buff, and I find it alarming that all of this happened, and it's terrible. And anyway, so
yes,
yeah,
so yeah, you know, we're coming out of the Great Depression.
Time.
Yeah, we're just starting to get, you know, the New Deal. Like, we're just starting to get our feet back under us, and the United States. I mean, we as a culture needed something to celebrate, so it hit just a good time where so many people sunk their teeth into it, and you know, like I said, it is Americana. You know, you list the top 100 things that make you think of America, it's got to be on the list. So it's part of our lore. It's part of our history. And yeah, so when it came out in 39, it was a huge hit, just a gargantuan.
Kind of a family friendly, but quite dark.
Oh yes.
For the times. Quite dark. Yeah. And I think it almost, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm just shooting from the hip here. Mm-hmm. In my recent journey down World War II history, I'm almost wondering if there weren't a lot of wartime themes that I hadn't thought about before. And oh boy, it'd be interesting to look into that.
You might be onto something. That was popular.
Interesting.
You might remember the cartoons from back then. They were
politicized,
even though they weren't openly politicized.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to date myself, and I remember those cartoons in the 1970s still playing on early morning cartoons.
Yeah.
They would throw in those wartime cartoons. I think they probably just had them as reruns, and they would come like after the main cartoons, and they would throw them in like around 11 o'clock or whatever, and they'd throw in the or they'd come on like super early at like 6:30, 7 a.m.
Yes.
And they're such a fascinating part of our history too.
Completely. I mean, because animation is such a how do I put this? It's such a unique art form because you have to tell a story one picture at a time. Or at least, you know, it was back in the 20th. Like, it was one frame at a time, and you had to link them all together to tell these stories. You know, and different houses went in different directions. You know, Warner Brothers, they didn't do the contemporary movies that Disney was doing. But at the same time, everybody knew Bugs Bunny and they knew Mickey Mouse. You know what I mean? It's fat.
And Roadrunner. Remember Roadrunner?
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
He could never. such great ones. But yeah, the old Mickey Mouse ones and that's fascinating. You bring that up. So 1939, the movie comes out. It's in Technicolor from black and white. Then it goes Technicolor.
And then back to black and white.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And the rich characters that were in that, it's just such a really important piece of history.
Well, the director and the producers, they made some very obvious choices. Like, I don't know if they ever read the book. I'd like to believe they did. I can't recall who wrote the screenplay, but I'm pretty sure that person read the book too, because it like I said, in the original Wizard of Oz, or I think it's called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, but don't quote me on it. There, like I said, there were four roads. There were four colored roads. You had the yellow brick, the red brick, the blue brick, and then the purple brick. I think they called it violet, but again, don't quote me on that. They incorporated the red brick road into the film. And, I don't know. I would have loved to have been in on the production, the pre-production and the set design when they decided to go with red. Because if you look at the scene in Munchkin Land, the houses, they're all pretty plain, but all of the Munchkins are dressed in these colors that are just over the top, one over another, each one is more colorful than the next. It's crazy. And that red road really stands out. You know, it does, it pops. So I wonder if they chose that, because it's a primary color along with yellow, or I don't know. I just, like I said, I would have loved to have been in on those conversations.
Yeah,
I love that behind-the-scenes stuff.
Do they show any of the other colors of the roads anywhere in the movie, or just the red one?
Not that I've ever noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, they may, but I've never noticed it.
Right. And so you remember seeing this, and when you were in high school, you got the idea for this, and your question was, where does that red brick road go?
Yeah, and I always wondered. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they solve it technically in the movie. If you watch enough and if you see just the right frame at just the right time, it looks like it goes to the mayor's house. But I mean, let's be honest, that's not really, I don't know.
What's kind of boring?
There you go. Yeah, I couldn't think of the right term. Thank you. That's exactly it. It's kind of boring.
It just goes to the mayor's house.
Yeah, what good is that? So.
And he was an interesting character.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And
so much pop culture came from that. I'll take you behind the curtain.
And yes. Yeah, and well, the thing is too with like the mayor, the mayor of Munchkinland ends up. I'm sorry, I can't say Munchkinland. The mayor of Munchkin Place ends up in my book as well. And it's interesting too. But I did a ton of research into this, because I wanted to bring parts of the actors into this book and parts of their their persona, I guess. I've never met them. I've never tried to interview them. I'm pretty sure they're all dead now. But I didn't want to reach out to families or anything like that. I tried to glean and take like a the creative, I don't know what you call it, like
creative license to just
that's the term. Thank
expand
you.
Expand on what you knew, kind of give it a little bit of life to it.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, it's been a heck of a journey. I mean, the universe is a wacky place, man. And it's, to be a teacher coming from finance, teaching business, everybody thinks I'm an English teacher when I tell them I'm a teacher. I teach business, but I'm a hell of a storyteller. And that's, kind of where we are now. I would, in an ideal world, I would love to sell many hundreds of thousands of these so that I wouldn't have to keep teaching and that I could go and just write for the rest of my life. That would be the best, man. That would be the best. So, yeah, if anybody's watching or listening who may be an executive with, maybe NBC Universal or Netflix or something like that, this could easily be a movie or, 6-7 part series.
Oh, definitely. Oh, I could. Oh, and you heard it right here on the Verbal Echo first. So if you could give either one of your students or anyone who's interested in writing a book, as opposed, if we compare self-publishing versus using a publisher, what advice could you give?
Oh boy. Okay. So since I'm a business teacher, I got to approach this from the two business tracks, right? Because we're talking about two different revenue streams for the author. Okay. On one hand, if you're going to self-publish, this means that everything is going to be on you for not only the initial costs, but also like all of the marketing as well, right? So you are on the hook for having somebody edit this. I mean, you could be good, don't get me wrong, but you will probably pay $3,000 to $8,000, depending on the length of what you have going on, to have somebody edit this. I had it priced out when I was originally doing it, and somebody said, yeah, I'll edit your book for $6,000. So editors are not cheap, okay? And many publishing houses have that ability, okay? So that's that chunk that you're out. And then there's the cover, and the cover design and all that. You've got to think about what that's got to look like. That's probably going to be mostly all on you. Don't get me wrong, you can get creative. Side note, I'll talk about it in a minute, but this for cover art actually was an idea that I had that I gave to one of my students. And I said, look, I'm not creative this way. I'm not artistic like that. But my student, Charlie, is very, very creative. And I said, look, I'll commission an art piece. I'll pay you accordingly. Come up with something. This is my idea. Let's see what you can do. And Charlie created this digital thing that was, it was actually pretty awesome. And it was what my vision was, and I paid Charlie for it. And I took that and I brought it to the publisher. And I said, look, this is a start. Where do you want to go from here? Because this is kind of what I have in mind. And the next thing I know, the publisher comes out with this. And I just, I love being able to give students opportunities like that. Now Charlie can put that in their portfolio.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know what I mean? And
What a great boost to young Charlie to have that on your resume. Yeah. Like, I'm published. I'm a published illustrator at 17 or whatever. However,
yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. Yeah, what an opportunity. That's real business teaching.
Yeah. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Absolutely. So anyway, if you're self-publishing, you know, all of this costs, you have to put out on, you know, like immediately, right? Then once you've got the actual proof and you have the book and you know how much, it, you know, then you got to find somebody who's going to create it. I know Amazon's got a branch, KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, like they can do that to self-publish. And that each copy will come at a cost. So you then have to price it not only in the market with everything else, but at a point where you're going to be making X amount of dollars per book. So then you've got to sit down and do the math. Okay, what am I, you know, I have to spend money on advertising because you got to spend money to make money. I got to spend money on advertising. Like, how much more am I going to spend? Is it going to be banners? Is it going to be bookmarks? Is, you know, am I going to be paying people to review this? What am I going to do? You know, so many other moving parts there that you have to put the money out up front. However, once you know how much you're making per book and you can get that book out and into places, I mean, all of it is yours. The you have no publishing house to take a piece of that. It's all revenue, all 100% for you. So it's a lot of work that's on you, right? I decided to try to find a publishing company instead. And, you know, we talk about persistence. That's what it is. It's a numbers game. There are so many publishers out there and, you know, they run the gamut as far as what they will publish. So whatever you've written, as long as it's halfway decent, is I don't know, as cheap as that sounds, if you've got something, there's a publishing house for you out there. It's just going to take time in order to find it, right?
And you have a list of 300. And it's interesting.
It was narrowed down to.
Right. And you narrowed it down just kind of randomly. You said, okay, a group of 30. Mm-hmm. And then, and because how hard was it really as far as time to submit to 30? You know, I'm sure there was a little copying and pasting involved. So you submit to the first 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got four, what was it? You said four back.
I had four responses within 48 hours.
25% of those. So that's really, that's pretty good odds.
I'm fortunate. I mean, yes, it is. And please don't get me wrong. It is pretty good odds. But at the same time, I recognize I'm fortunate. I'm kind of lucky. I have, you know, when I found Chicken House Press, they are a small indie publisher outside of Toronto. And in fact, they were just named the best indie publisher and best indie Canadian publisher, which I think is pretty damn cool.
Chicken House Press.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what they say, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
That's yes, precisely. Yep.
You know, so I think that's kind of what you did is you said, all right, I can't submit to 300 right now this week. However, I can take 10% of that and just focus on that. And
chunk it down. Exactly. Mm-hmm, and so, you know, when I chose to find a publisher, I knew that there'd be a contract involved. I knew that they would end up with a piece of the sales, obviously. I knew that however, they would be taking care of the editing. I don't get me wrong. Chicken House was awesome where they allowed me a lot of creative freedom. It was a partnership more than it was a dictatorship, which I love. I worked directly with the owner and she and I would go back and forth about some things. It was fantastic. Alana and Chicken House, I can't speak highly enough of them because they didn't take anything away from this book that I wasn't okay with. Does that make sense? Like when we were going through the whole process of editing, things that were removed in order to make it a better book, I understood. you know, things that had to get changed and corrected made sense. It's always good to have another set of eyes on something, you know?
Absolutely. Especially during the editing process, because
yeah,
even if you use Hemingway or what's the other big one? The other editing one, Grammarly, you know, like
yes.
It definitely is helpful. However, you still need a second set of human eyes to look
yeah.
at it.
yeah. And I found out early on, Grammarly aids me. Because and I'll tell you why. A lot of the dialogue within Rent Brick Road, I write very conversational. So I use words like gonna, G-O-N-N-A. Well, I was gonna. I mean, we all say it.
We say it. Yeah.
You know what? Exactly. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. That's a word with two apostrophes. We don't think about it, but it's S-H-O-U-L-D-N apostrophe T apostrophe V-E. Shouldn't have.
That's true.
You know what I mean? So
grammar,
you know, like, yeah, exactly. We say I shouldn't have. So I write like that. And Grammarly, like, they were like, no, no. Danger.
This is wrong. Danger.
Exactly.
Red.
Yeah. So I backed right out of Grammarly, and I took it upon myself. And luckily, you know, like I said, Alana and Chicken House saw what I was trying to do with this, and they ran with it. And yeah, anyway, the whole process of self-publishing versus finding a publisher, you know, they took a lot off of my plate as far as the art and the editing goes, which is great. They're helping with the marketing, which is fantastic. As far as, you know, ordering these books, like I have a few copies here at the house, you know, which I sell. I mean, it's, you know, it says right on the back, the retail price is $15.99. So if you buy it from me or if you buy it from a store, like it's going to cost the same. And then, speaking of which, buying it, whether it's being through a publisher or self-published, you have to find a distribution network. And that, again, that was an education in and of itself. It's crazy. But to make a long story a short one, Chicken House uses Ingram, I-N-G-R-A-M, as a distribution network. A lot of self-publishers have had a lot of luck with Ingram as well, because they allow something with exit called POD, print on demand. So if you need something, you know, printed and shipped, you know, it can get done relatively quickly, which is mind-boggling when you stop and think, you know. And then one other thing was getting the blurbs. And, you know, like on the back, I had a couple of friends and early readers talk about the book. But the one that I love is actually right here on the front, and it's from James Fry, the New York Times number one bestseller, you know, the guy that was on Oprah. Like, if you look up James Fry, he is a big deal, and he's a heck of an author. And he agreed to a blurb for the front of my book. And it says, funny, heady, and a new take on what we knew about The Wizard of Oz, definitely worth your time. I'm totally floored and flattered by that.
Mm-hmm. And the publisher set those up, the blurbs.
I did.
Oh, you did. Okay.
I did. Yep. Actually, I set them up. And that's the funny part, is that a lot of people ask me, oh my God, how did you get James Fry on the front of your book? Turns out he went to high school with my brother out in Michigan.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Connections.
Yep. Right. And they kept in touch, and I emailed him, and the guy was fantastic. And to this day, I'm floored and flattered and honored that he would say that. So.
That's awesome.
You just never know, man. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the universe is a wacky place. It's awesome.
It is. And the journey is twisty and turning.
Mm.
And not so straight.
Oh, my God.
And thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your journey as a writer.
Anytime. I mean that.
Yeah. Where can people find your book?
Let's see. It's available through Barnes & Noble, through Amazon, at a lot of local places. In fact, I just real quick side note, I was in Las Vegas for the first time in April, and I went into this bookshop called The Writer's Block in Las Vegas because I had heard that they had stocked my book, and I was totally flattered and floored by that. And so I go into The Writer's Block in Vegas, and I said, you know, hi, I'm J.T. Maxwell, and I wrote Red Brick Road. And they were like, oh, we just sold out. We're going to have to order more. Because, you know, I figured I'd signed a couple for them. And they sold out. And, like, my jaw's on the floor. I can't believe this. Like, holy crap, they sold out of my book. And, yeah, so anyway.
In Vegas. It's a, that's awesome.
In Las Vegas, right. And I've never been before. I'm definitely going back. But it, regardless, it's, yeah, it, you can find it.
So Barnes & Noble, Amazon, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And yep. So do you have a website that you'd like to direct people to?
Not quite yet. I wish I did. But you can find me on both Facebook and Instagram at author J.T. Maxwell. And that's all
awesome.
One word. J-T-M-A-X-W-E-L-L.
Perfect. And you have some books upcoming. You said you've got one in the works right now.
Yeah, I'm 11,000 words into my next one. You know, Red Brick Road was about 76,000 words for what it's worth. So, and I discovered that too, like quite by accident. This is how you know you're talking to a writer when they don't talk about page count and they talk about word count.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Word count.
Yeah. So you have a goal in mind, and of course that's before editing. And
I'm hoping that I can be on here again with another book at another time. This has been fantastic, Monica.
Maybe I can write a blurb for you.
Dude, that would be fantastic.
That'd be awesome.
That would be so cool. Yes.
And this is how we make connections.
Yeah.
Love it. Love
making
it.
Making a note of it.
The value of community cannot be underestimated.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much, JT, for coming on and sharing this writer's journey. It's been fascinating. So everyone, check out the book. Get it. Don't wait. Find out where the red brick road really goes.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening today to another great episode. I sure enjoy hearing about these experiences, and I hope you do also. Be sure and like or follow this show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have an experience or story you'd like to share, be sure and reach out to verbalecho@gmail.com. See you in the next episode, friends. Have a great week.